This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
So we tell you calmly and very sincerely, if you're frightened easily, turn off your radio now.
On September 20th, 2017, record-smashing Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. Thousands died because of it. New science confirms the devastating rains and floods during Maria were far more likely due to climate change. According to recent data from the U.S. Census Bureau, after the storm, about 4% of the population of the island fled for the United States mainland. They are among the new American climate refugees, joining those from Hurricanes Harvey and Katrina. The new paper is titled Extreme Rainfall Associated with Hurricane Maria Over Puerto Rico and Its Connections to Climate Variability and Change. We have reached the lead author, Dr. David J. Keelings, Assistant Professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Alabama. From Tuscaloosa, David Keelings, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Just 8 days before Maria struck, you and your co-author, Jose Hernandez Ayala, published research on extreme floods and tropical cyclones in Puerto Rico. What got you studying that even before the big disaster struck?
My co-author is actually from Puerto Rico. He grew up there, and so he still has family there, and his wife's family are from there. So he's very much still in touch with people on the island, and we both have an interest in extreme events, and particularly precipitation, especially out of hurricanes. So we got together. We both actually overlapped for a while in graduate school, so we knew each other, and decided to look into what was going on in Puerto Rico. It's a very interesting place climatologically because it's a very small island, but it has a very disproportionate amount of very high flows, high river flows. Most of the really extreme flows that are recorded for the entire United States are coming from Puerto Rico and Hawaii, you know, two tropical islands that get huge amounts of hydrologic variability in their response to rainfall. So it's an interesting place to look at.
Would you say the people of that island were relatively adapted to heavy rainfall before Hurricane Maria struck?
I suspect so. I've never visited, but historically they're no stranger to very extreme variability in rainfall and in flooding events. Most of their basins, their rivers can go orders of magnitude and, you know, variability in terms of their flow almost overnight. They're very used to huge changes in their hydrology.
David, what made the rains of Maria so exceptional?
Well, that's what the paper was looking at. The first thing that we did was we basically had three questions that we wanted to answer. The first one was how unusual was Maria in the climatology and the history of the island going back to the beginning of the record that we had, 1956, which is when we kind of have reliable data back to. And so we wanted to know, was it really unusual? We found out that it was. It's a lot heavier precipitation than any other hurricane event that's impacted the island in the last, you know, 60-some years. And not just that it's the highest, but also it's significantly higher than anything that's happened before, 30 to 60%, depending on what metric you're looking at, but 30 to 60% higher than previous storms like Hurricane George's in 98 and tropical storm Isabel too. It's so much higher than these other events. And then the second thing that we wanted to ask was, is something like Maria's magnitude of precipitation, is that becoming more likely through the record? And what we found was it is becoming much more likely from the 1950s to today's climate. It's become about three times more likely to happen in the climate of today versus at the beginning of the record. And then finally, we wanted to, and this comes back to your question, we wanted to get at this question of what is causing this change and what can we attribute this increased likelihood of this kind of event in Puerto Rico to? Is it part of natural cycles of variability, or is it part of a longer-term trend, i.e. climate change. And so we went about that using a fairly complex statistical methodology where we essentially look at the climate at the beginning of the record, we look at the climate of 2017 when Maria happened, and we estimate probability of Maria in these two settings. But we then construct a what we call counterfactual reality. We construct a world that never was, a world that has all of the natural variability that was present in 2017 when Maria happened, but the one thing that we change that makes it not reality anymore is we dial back climate change to what it was in the 1950s. So things like global atmospheric temperature, we dial that back to 1950s. We dial back the amount of moisture in the atmosphere. We dial back the sea surface temperatures. We dial back the CO2 in the atmosphere. And then we re-estimate the probability of something like Maria's rainfall happening. And then we can compare those probabilities to each other. And when we do that, so we're isolating the impact of human-induced climate change by doing this, we find that Maria's rainfall is actually five times more likely in the climate of today under climate change, under the human influence on the climate, versus what it was in the 1950s without as much human-induced climate change. So, you know, to say that a hurricane like Maria is caused by something is very difficult to do, and you should be very, very careful of that. What we are able to do with attribution science these days, and attribution science is a relatively new field, but what we are able to do is estimate changing likelihood, changing probability or risk of events happening. And what we're able to say with something like Maria is it is X times more likely because of long-term trends associated with climate change. And again, what we found is it's now about five times more likely.
So does that mean that Puerto Rico and the Caribbean should experience more big storms like that sooner than we would have otherwise thought?
Well, again, we can't really say that climate change is causing hurricanes. Hurricanes are chaotic events. They're random events. They're extreme events, and they're happening in a chaotic global atmosphere. So in any year, there's the chance that you will have hurricanes happening. But again, they're random events, and there's many natural processes that cause fewer or more hurricanes in any given year. What we're saying is that when a hurricane does form, when those random chaotic conditions are just right and a hurricane gets going, in a warming climate, that hurricane is more likely to intensify. It's more likely to become higher category hurricane, and it's more likely to do that at a faster pace. It's more likely to go from a category 1 to a 2, 3, 4, all the way up to 5 much more quickly. So it's more likely to spend a longer part of its lifespan at a higher category and be more intense. And when it moves over land, it's likely to drop more rainfall when it's moving over the land. There's also a lot of research out there that's saying now that hurricanes under climate change are moving slower. They have what's called slower translational speed. So if you imagine a hurricane coming over the top of you and it's dropping all of that rain, it's really bad if it's moving slower, because then it spends longer over the top of you and it drops more rainfall at your particular location. So under climate change, all of these things are likely to change in hurricanes. They're likely to be more intense, intensify more rapidly, spend longer part of their lifespan at higher intensity, and also to drop more precipitation. These are all things that have been theoretically known for decades now. If you asked an atmospheric scientist or a climate scientist 40 years ago, what would happen if we warmed up the planet? What would happen if the air temperature increased? What would happen if the sea surface increased? What would happen if, because of that, the atmosphere can hold more moisture? And you said to them, what's going to happen if a hurricane forms in that kind of climate? They would tell you, oh, it's going to intensify faster. It's probably going to spend longer at a higher category, and it's also going to drop more rainfall. These are things that are no surprise based on our scientific physical understanding of what hurricanes do. But now with attribution science, we can actually say okay, these things that we have always known are likely to happen, we can now say that they are happening, and we can attribute it to something like climate change. So that's what's particularly exciting in the field at the moment. So yeah, going back to your question about the Caribbean, you know, we can't say that more hurricanes are necessarily going to happen, but we can say that when one does happen, if it interacts with an island in the Caribbean, it's probably going to be a higher intensity hurricane than it would have been otherwise, and it's definitely going to drop more rainfall than it would have done otherwise.
Science warns we should expect about 7% more water vapor in the air for every 1 degree of ocean warming. Now, a new report from the World Meteorological Organization says in 2018, the heat content of the upper levels of the ocean were the highest ever recorded. I'm wondering, maybe will we see a new scale of hurricane rains, maybe off the scale? Do you think we'll need a Category 6 designation for the coming storms?
Yeah, you know, possibly some researchers have hinted at that that's a possibility, that, again, hurricanes are likely to intensify faster and they're likely to spend longer at those higher categories. You know, I think that there is a physical upper limit. There's a bound there. You can't go too much off the scale in terms of hurricanes. There is a thermodynamic limit that they will reach. But I think it is highly likely, yes, that hurricanes, again, when the conditions are right and one does happen, it's likely that it's going to spend longer as an intense hurricane, a Category 4, a Category 5, and perhaps even wind speeds that are edging to the, you know, upper limits of Category 5, it's likely to spend longer with those kinds of conditions, and it's certainly likely to drop more precipitation because there's, just as you said, every 1 degree Celsius that we warm up, there's more moisture in the atmosphere. The hurricane is working with that more moisture, and it's able to convert that into rainfall.
Just out of curiosity, is there a name or a definite level for that thermodynamic limit to the power of hurricanes?
You know, that's not really something I study. Wouldn't like to hazard a guess on that, but I'm sure that from what I read, that yes, there is a limit that hurricanes can reach, yes.
All right. You, in your paper, also talk about other factors that can beef up wind speeds and the amount of water carried in hurricanes in the mid-Atlantic region. You talk about the El Niño-La Niña balance or the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation. Were those factors in Maria, as far as you know?
Well, yes. So what we did was to look at our attribution statement again. We're looking at the climate as it was in 2017 with all of these natural influences, and then we're comparing that to the climate sort of counterfactual reality of 2017, but dialing back the longer-term trends that are associated with climate change. So as we do that, we keep North Atlantic Oscillation, Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation, El Niño. We keep all of those things in there. And so we didn't look at those natural factors directly, other than when you look at the paper, we do say that in observational record, the probability of something of Maria's magnitude of precipitation has gone, at the beginning of the record in the 1950s, has gone from about a 300-year return event down to about 100-year return event in the climate of today. And so as you know, but I'll go over this briefly, as you know, a return period is an estimate of probability. So people have often heard of the 500-year flood or the 100-year flood. This is a statement of probability. It does not mean that a 100-year flood happens this year and it will not happen again for 100 years. There's a probability of it happening in every single year. A 100-year flood just means that in any given year, there's a 1% chance of it happening. And so we went from a 300-year event, so that's a chance in any given year of about 0.3%, to down to a 1 in 100-year return period event, so that's a 1% chance. So that's about a 3 times increase in the probability of Maria happening when we just look at the observational record. Now, when we did our attribution study as part of this, what we found was about a 5 times increase in the likelihood of Maria's precipitation when we isolate the effects of climate change alone. So there's a discrepancy there between the 3 times increase in likelihood that we found from the observational record versus the 5 times increase that we found when we attribute that change to climate change alone. So that suggests to us that that discrepancy between the 5 times and the 3 times increase in likelihood has to do with natural factors like ENSO, like NEO, like AMO, actually counteracting the effect of climate change to some extent. So we can probably say with some certainty that natural factors should actually reduce the effect of climate change in the instance of Maria as it was in 2017. So in other words, if only climate change was acting on increasing the likelihood of Maria, Maria should be 5 times more likely, but it's only 3 times more likely. So that means that El Nino and NEO and AMO actually reduced that likelihood a little bit. So they are actually favorable for reducing the intensity of Maria in 2017.
Thank you for explaining that. I had not heard that before. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. David Keeling from the University of Alabama. We're talking about extreme rains from the new breed of climate-enhanced hurricanes, or at least the probability of that happening. Now, David, closer to your home state of Alabama, or now it's your home state, I guess, a report released in April by NOAA and the National Weather Service upgrades Hurricane Michael to Category 5, and that joins only 3 Cat 5 hurricanes to make landfall in the continental United States. Michael smashed Florida in the panhandle on October 7, 2018. Did you feel the effects of that storm in Alabama?
Yeah, we did. We did to some extent. I'm in Tuscaloosa, which is more kind of in northern Alabama. We're about 4 hours away from the Gulf of Mexico if you were to drive it. So we didn't feel a huge impact up here, but certainly in southern Alabama, they did, and round about, as you said, the panhandle in Florida. By the time it was further north, we got some wind and we got some rain, but it was not a severe impact like they had in the panhandle.
There's a bunch of new studies out on Hurricane Harvey and the increased risks of extreme rains hitting the U.S. Gulf Coast. And one study found, and I'll quote Dr. Jeff Masters here, climate change made Hurricane Florence's most intense rains over North Carolina in 2018 more than 50% greater in magnitude than they would have been otherwise. David, what do you make of this burst of new science and the pattern coming out of it as warming develops?
Well, I think it's all very interesting. I think that most of these studies, including my own, I mean, they've been conducted by independent researchers, and in many ways we use varied techniques and varied data sets to look at these things. And I think it's interesting that all of these studies are independently finding very similar results. We're all finding that the rainfall being produced by these high category storms is increasing significantly. And also we're all finding that we can attribute that increase in rainfall intensity to climate change. And so this is very, very interesting. It's something, again, that theoretically we've known for several decades, but now we're actually able to say, okay, we're seeing this happening, and we can actually say with some certainty that climate change is playing a role in the increased precipitation that we're seeing.
A few years ago, you did some interesting research into increasing heat waves expected in Florida as climate change develops. What should people there expect?
So, yeah, we looked at the likelihood of heat waves. Heat waves are very difficult to define. There are many different definitions of what constitutes a heat wave. There's just about as many definitions of a heat wave as there are studies on heat waves. But we looked at extremely high daily maximum temperatures, also co-occurring with very high nighttime minimum temperatures, because if you look at the public health and epidemiology literature, health professionals are concerned about not just it being really hot during the daytime hours, but also it remaining hot over nighttime hours, so people don't get a sort of chance to recuperate during the nighttime when normally it would cool down. If it stays hot at night, it, it's bad news, as well as it being hot during the daytime. So we looked at what's called a bivariate approach to heat waves, where we looked at the maximum and the minimum. And what we found is that in the last or most recent 25 years of temperature records in Florida, we see this increasing likelihood of heat waves, not just in terms of frequency or the number of events that have occurred, but also we're seeing changes in the duration of those events, so how long a heat wave will last for. Obviously, the longer a heat wave goes on, the more chance that more people are going to be impacted by it. And also we found that the magnitude of the events are increasing generally when heat waves are happening. In the most recent 25-year period, we're seeing that they're more intense heat waves. And then also we found, interestingly, that the timing of events is changing through the year. Heat waves are happening earlier and earlier in the summertime. And that's particularly concerning because heat waves and their impact on people has a lot to do with people's acclimatization to heat. When a heat wave happens later on in the summertime, people are already acclimatized to those warmer temperatures. They're used to it. They're already in summer. They know it's hot out and their bodies are more adjusted to it. So when heat waves are changing their timing in the year and happening earlier, it's going to catch people out when people are not acclimatized to those really high temperatures. So suddenly you hit people in the springtime with a really bad heat wave, then it's going to impact more people.
And it also has a big effect on agriculture. I've lived in Florida before, and I know that all of that timing really matters to the people who are producing a lot of the nation's agricultural products.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, heat waves put a huge stress on crops, and, you know, particularly in the summertime in places like Florida, it's already hot. If you have a heat wave, typically heat waves are also accompanied by clear skies, lack of rainfall, and so you're really stressing the crops with a really intense temperatures that wilts the crops, but also a lack of rainfall, so they don't get any evaporative cooling, and they also, you know, they don't get any replenishing of their soil moisture, so it's particularly stressful for plants.
David, what are you working on next, and in your field of interest, what critical science do you think could tell us more?
Well, I'm currently working on a project to look at heat waves across the continental United States. We're kind of taking a somewhat novel approach, in that we're looking at heat waves much more spatially. We're thinking about them more as geometric shapes or blobs, if you will, on the landscape. Because we already know fairly well in the literature, this has been observed for a long time now, and we're very certain of this in the science, is that heat waves generally globally are becoming much more frequent, much higher in their magnitude, much more intense, and longer duration. This is something that, you know, for example, the IPCC talks about in their reports, that we're very, very certain that heat waves are increasing in these ways and likely to continue to increase in magnitude, intensity, and frequency as we move forward under a change in climate. And so what we're trying to do is actually look at heat waves and think about their size. So we know that heat waves, like I said, are becoming more frequent and higher in their magnitude, but we've not really known when a heat wave happens, is it becoming bigger? Is it larger? Is it affecting more people over a larger area when it occurs? And has that got anything to do with climate change? Is it some sort of manifestation of a warming climate on the land surface to affect the size and shape of heat waves? So that's kind of what I'm working on right now, to look at, okay, we know more are going to happen, but are they going to be bigger in terms of the aerial extent? So yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of interesting work going on in the scientific community at the moment in terms of climate science. I think that the attribution work that I've been involved with to some extent, and what so many other independent groups are working on, is highly exciting. This ability to now answer sort of what the public may be wondering about. You know, the public thinks about climate change, and always after a storm or a heat wave, there's always questions of, was this caused by human-induced climate change? And we still can't say if any one particular event is caused by climate change. Was it a physical mechanism that caused it? We can't say that, but what we can say is how much more likely these sorts of events are now than what they used to be. And we can also say how that likelihood is likely to change moving forward. And I think that this is something that's very powerful. It's very useful for people to know. And I think it should be something that influences policymakers, hopefully.
We have been talking with scientist David Keelings from the University of Alabama, and you can find links to this paper about climate change and the deadly rains of Hurricane Maria and all the hurricane news we've been discussing in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
You're very welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
When the Arctic sea ice crashed in 2007, it was a great signal of human interference in the climate of this planet. Now, Swiss researchers have found another. Beginning in 2010, giant heat waves appeared in multiple places around the Earth at the same time. Dr. Marco Fokel is a postdoctoral researcher of land climate dynamics at ETH Zurich, the Swiss Federal Institute of Science and Technology. She is co-author of a paper still awaiting publication but already causing waves. Although based in Zurich, we reached Marta in Budapest. Marco Fokel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, good afternoon.
Tell us about the massive heat experienced in many places around the Northern Hemisphere in 2018, please.
We were investigating the areas which were concurrently affected by hot extremes in 2018 in the Northern Hemisphere. Multiple regions in the Northern Hemisphere experienced heat-related impacts at the same time. What we were doing then was to consider hot days in key agricultural and densely populated regions in the Northern Hemisphere, because these are the regions which can be strongly exposed to extreme heat. We computed the areas which were concurrently affected by hot days in 2018. We found that this was a large area. And if we're considering the area that was affected between May and July in 2018, we found that it was on average 22% of the Northern Hemispheric region, which is densely populated or key agricultural region. If you are looking at these 22% from 2018, which were on average affected every day between May and July, it makes a new record. So if you are considering these areas from 1958 to 2018, there was a strong increase in the recent state. And also in 2010, we had a large area that was affected by concurrent extreme heat. But 2018 makes a new record if you're considering the area between May and July.
So during these times, I mean, we had things like rails melting and there were heat deaths and some crop failures. So there are a lot of ramifications to what you're describing.
Yes, that's why we think it's really necessary to look at the areas which are actually affected, because if you have key agricultural regions and densely populated areas, this can have strong implications. We collected media articles and we found that in at least 17 countries across the Northern Hemisphere, multiple impacts were reported. So we found these damages to infrastructure, but also crop failure in Central Europe, in the United Kingdom, and then also in other regions. And even lots of people were directly affected by extreme heat, and heat deaths were reported in Japan and South Korea also.
It's interesting because each of us experiences the heat. We had a very hot year here in British Columbia, and we had a lot of wildfires. But we don't put it together as a world picture, and I wonder who is responsible for tracking heat and finding what you found.
This is really the main message from our study, that we have this strong impact which occurred in many regions at the same time, and this can then have strong implications. You mentioned the fires in British Columbia. And also there were lots of wildfires in Scandinavia. If we experience such events more often in the future, and one country already has large areas which are affected by fires, and another country also calls for emergency, and there can be limited infrastructure to actually fight the fires. And therefore, we consider a multi-model ensemble from state-of-the-art model simulation and computed probabilities of such large areas to have occurred in a case with climate change and in a case without climate change. And here we focus on a historical period where we experience the climate change signals to be small. And when we are doing so, we actually find that in this historical period where we think that the climate change signal was small, that such large areas like 2018 never occur. So this leads to the conclusion that actually human-induced climate change was necessary for such an event to occur. So a 2018-like heatwave area could not have occurred without human-induced climate change.
It's interesting, though, that some of your earlier research that you co-authored brings up a question, because you looked into the year 1540 and what appeared to be a very hot time then, and now 500 years later, we have another series of heat waves. And as soon as I looked at news of your research, because it hasn't been published yet, is that correct? Not published yet?
Yeah, that's still under review, yeah. It's minor revision, so it's in the process.
As soon as I heard about it, I thought about the 2010 heat wave where Russia, one of the world's largest wheat exporters, suffered so much crop loss that they canceled grain exports. And I was thinking, well, what if North America also lost wheat to heat at the same time? There could have been a food crisis, possibly even famine. Does your new research suggest perhaps we're entering an age where multiple food failures could occur?
Actually, our results can point into this direction, because we investigated also climate model projections for the future, and we found that in a case where we have 2 degrees global warming, such an area like 2018 could occur on average nearly every year. So if you imagine that the 2018-like area would occur on average every year, this can have strong implications, for example, on food security. So if you have multiple breadbaskets where we have crop failure at the same time, then this can also have strong implications on trade, and trade cannot face these crop failure, because when they occur in multiple regions at the same time, and this can then have actually strong implications on food security. And also, if we consider like many areas concurrently affected by wildfires, then we can also get a problem with infrastructure to actually fight the fires. Our results show that under 1 degree warming, such an area like 2018 could occur 1 out of 6 years. So even today, it's not unlikely, but it was still an unprecedented event. If we go in future for 1.5 degree global warming, then we find that every 2 out of 3 years such an event could occur. And if you go then even to 2 degree global warming, well, such an event could occur nearly every year on average. So that means we could find such a year like 2018 could occur nearly every year. And then also it would be more difficult to compensate last year's failure if the next year, again, the large area will be under extreme heat. So this can have really strong implications, because if you have a year like 1 out of 6 years, then the other years you might compensate the losses from 1 year. But if such an event would occur nearly every year on average, then we can expect strong impacts.
So we would possibly have no time to recover from the damages the year previous. Marta Fogel, based on earlier science you co-authored, is it possible heat events are also due or affected by large-scale land use changes in Europe and across the mid-latitudes?
Heat waves can have multiple causes, and we find that there's like smoking situation is necessary to large heat waves to occur, but then also processes on land really can amplify the development of heat waves. So what we were focusing on our research group is really the climate dynamics or land atmosphere feedback. And also if you have land use change and then we change, for example, from forest to grass, so moisture and latent heat flux, and therefore can also influence the development of heat waves.
Canadian government scientists just released a report saying Canada is warming at twice the global average. In earlier work, your group says Central Europe is also expected to warm more strongly than the world average. First of all, for our international audience, what is meant by Central Europe? And second, why would that region warm more than many other places?
Actually, when we are talking about global warming or global mean temperature, whole world and all areas on land, we have a stronger increase in temperature than over the global, because the globe is after the strong regions, which are the ocean, and this, the ocean cools less strong than the land. So when we are looking on land regions, we always find a stronger warming signal than most areas on land. We find stronger warming than global mean temperature, because land warms faster than the ocean.
It's interesting because people picture Switzerland as a cooler, mountainous place, but Switzerland was also struck by excessive heat last year?
Yes, hot temperatures. And what was also the case for Switzerland was that it was a really dry year last year. And if we have a dry year, and which is accompanied by also like a hot and dry year, then there can be feedback processes that accelerate the warming. And of course also, for example, crop harvest.
You were tuned to Radio EcoShock. My guest is Dr. Marta Fokel from ETH Zurich. We are discussing brand new science about the massive heat waves appearing across the Northern Hemisphere in recent years. Marta, do you have any indication that this is purely a Northern Hemisphere phenomenon? Could it also happen in the Southern Hemisphere, or is there too much ocean there for this to occur?
We were really focusing on Northern Hemisphere because we wanted to focus on the Northern Hemisphere spring and summer, but also in the Southern Hemisphere, there are strong heat-related impacts. There was a heat wave occurring. For example, Australia was also affected by strong heat. Last year also, I think it was even ongoing until this year. But we really, because of the timing of summer and spring, we really focused on the Northern Hemisphere.
Recently, you presented the new findings on simultaneous heat waves at the European Geosciences Union press conference in Vienna. Did you get feedback from other scientists? What are they saying?
We have a novelty in our study that we were really investigating the area which was concurrently affected by hot extremes. And often if you're looking on heat waves, we consider on the magnitude or the duration. And this time we really considered the area which was concurrently affected by extreme heat. So in 2018, it might not be that there was one large heat wave, but in many regions at the same time there were heat waves. And I think the scientists, they found our, they were surprised by the results, and they find it really a good idea to look at the area that was concurrently affected by hot extremes.
Yes. Could you just describe one of those heat waves, whether it's 2010 or 2012 or 2018, and talk to us about where the heat appeared, what countries, what regions?
Okay. We were looking in 2018 on hot days, so the days that were much warmer than the 90% of the climatological period. And we focused on key agriculture and densely populated areas in the Northern Hemisphere because they can be strongly exposed to extreme heat. So the hot days we were considering, they were occurring in the US, in Canada, in many regions in Europe, like in the UK, in Scandinavia, including Finland, Sweden, Norway, and also in Denmark, in the Netherlands, in Germany, in Switzerland, in France, Portugal, also more really to the east in Asia. We were considering Japan and South Korea, where there was a large number of hot days in 2018.
From the Swiss University ETH Zurich, we have been speaking with Dr. Marta Fokel. She is co-author of a new paper still in review about multiple simultaneous heat events that have appeared since 2010. I will put links to an article about this in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Marta, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, no problem.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock.
The world's upside down, isn't it? It's all run by complete madmen and idiots, and basically men who don't know what they're doing, and they're just stuffing their pockets.
Let me tell you a story of how we humans are. A friend with arthritis got a prescription for a medication called diclofen. Rubbed on the skin, it does help stop the pain for a while. Only when checking on the web did he discover that diclofen is absolutely toxic to cats. A woman who applied it to her knees reported her cat died after licking her knees. But it goes much further than that. We may not see vultures much longer, due to diclofen being given to humans and to animals. In India, diclofen was given to cows, and it has led to the disappearance of an astounding 99% of India's vultures. That is a giant, unspeakable loss in nature. The unconsumed offal or rotting animals led to a big increase in wild dogs, which brought rabies and fear to children. I think that drug is now banned for veterinary use in India, but did we learn anything after wiping out India's vultures with an unnecessary drug? No. After that, Spain approved diclofen for animal use in 2013. Spain has about 90% of the last vultures of Europe. Here we go again. It's another example of our group insanity. Apparently, we cannot stop killing nature, even when the killing is totally unnecessary. Humans do not even know we are doing that. Take another horrible example. Perhaps you have seen a stunning documentary on the amazing emperor penguins managing to raise their chicks in the harsh conditions of Antarctica. Perhaps your children have seen those penguins in cartoon movies. But the world's second largest colony of emperor penguins has just experienced its third year of what scientists call almost total breeding failure. In the journal Antarctic Science, a new study by the British Atlantic Survey says changes in the ice in this age of global warming threatens to wipe out around 7% of the world's total penguin population in this one area. The emperor penguin colony at Halley Bay looks like it is going extinct. Half a planet away, people are flying and driving around as though we are not responsible for heating up the planet. Our emissions are killing the great emperor penguins. This leads me to another problem that has escaped my best efforts to capture it. I'm talking about ocean warming. About 90% of our excess warming of this planet goes into the oceans. We would be frying right now if that didn't happen. You know water heats slowly and then cools slowly, releasing that heat. I can find scientists who study and explain that the ocean is warming. The World Meteorological Society just released a report saying the top 700 meters of the sea is warming the most. But who can tell what that means when the impacts pop up all over the place, from Antarctic penguin breeding grounds, to dying coral off Australia, to bigger storms wiping out Caribbean islands, to Arctic ice threatening the last polar bears as it disappears? Perhaps it's a story that's just too big to tell. According to the latest quarterly report from the Carbon Brief, the first few months of 2019 have set new records for ocean heat content, with a particularly pronounced jump in February and March 2019. Carbon Brief continues, quote, "In many ways, ocean heat content represents a much better measure of climate change than global average surface temperatures. It is where most of the extra heat ends up and is much less variable on a year-to-year basis than surface temperatures. Most years set a new record for ocean heat content, and 2019 has been no exception so far, with the first 3 months showing the warmest OHC since records began. Changes in the amount or rate of warming are much easier to detect in the ocean heat content record than on the surface. For example, OHC shows little evidence of the slowdown in warming in the mid-2000s seen in surface temperature records. It also shows a distinct acceleration after 1991, matching the increased rate of greenhouse gas emissions over the past few decades," end quote. And I have seen scientists, especially from China, suggesting that we should get away from using heating on land temperatures and just measure what is happening in the upper ocean. What I'm hearing is that the current land-based warming of 1 degree over pre-industrial times, accepted by most scientists, is not as reliable as measuring heat changes in the sea. Plus, we have buried massive amounts of heat in the ocean, and that will all come back to life. We'll come back in the atmosphere over the next few centuries. So, we can set a target of 2 degrees warming, which I think is a dangerous fantasy right now, but whatever goals we set, the ocean will keep returning more and more of our past heat to the atmosphere and our lives, if we still have lives. Here is just another small example. The famous beaches of Mexico's Caribbean coast are being covered by masses of brown, slimy seaweed. It is the Sargasso coming in from the offshore Sargasso Sea areas of the Atlantic. But now, with heated waters in the prime tourist areas, this seaweed is taking over. Despite efforts to clean it up every day, the beaches are littered with smelly, rotting seaweed. Tourist visits have dropped significantly, and that is the only industry locals have to survive on. That is due to ocean warming. Of course, there are likely hundreds of millions of people in the tropics who depend directly or indirectly on money coming from tourism. But that whole industry, the very idea of flying around for pleasure, must die until we reach the times of fossil fuel-free airplanes. One solar plane managed to fly around the world over a period of a year. We could revive sailing ships, which take a month or two to reach the resorts, but in the near term, I'm calling on every one of you to stop that madness. The time of flying anywhere for a vacation is over. It is killing the planet. We are killing a livable climate for fun.
Why ain't you done more about climate change? Emissions are going up and up and up. You better act now, young man, while we still have enough time to do something about it.
I mean, I don't like to preach. My own carbon struggle continues. I prefer to let you come to your own conclusions. But isn't it time, finally now, to talk like this? How can we continue to daydream about our big vacation, which will kill off more life and wreck our kids' future? How can we admire people who do travel and keep silent about what we know? I'm hoping the next conference of the parties, the COP still to come, the big climate meetings, will all be held by video with no one traveling, or at least no one flying. Let's stop this madness.
Now, we don't know if tomorrow is scheduled, so we want to be sure that we have enough money to enjoy our lifestyle today.
Meanwhile, the warming oceans are licking away at the bottom of glaciers at both poles, speeding up the way that they slide into the sea. Arctic sea ice is again at a new record low in January 2019. Antarctic sea ice is shrinking, as reported on Radio EcoShock. Antarctic glaciers are now sliding into the sea. They are unstoppable, as NASA warned a couple of years ago. Glacial melt is now passing simple expansion due to heat of the oceans as a source of sea level rise. According to the Smithsonian Institute, today sea level is 5 to 8 inches, 13 to 20 centimeters, higher on average than it was in the year 1900. The seas are rising faster since 1990, increasing every year, and will continue to rise for the next 1,000 years at least. There is no coastline now, just a temporary place where the ocean is soon to arrive. Coastal real estate markets are just beginning to hear the real news. When you add it all up, the world economy must soon begin to shiver and shake. It must, if we want to survive. As George Monbiot bravely says, unsocial capitalism is killing not just us, but most life as we know it. It is an experiment that has failed. The crucial link for your survival now is not whether you can keep a car or a TV, but whether you will have adequate food and water. Watch the food chain, learn what is happening in world food markets, and start the process of learning to grow and live from local fossil-free food. As you've heard in this show, there could be multiple heat waves at the same time in breadbasket countries, and you need to be prepared for that. I think most of the young people, sad to say, those below 20 years old now, will not live where they are growing up. So much of the world will become uninhabitable. The surviving millions will have to move toward the poles and towards the highlands, as the birds and the fish are already doing. Northern Canada, Alaska, Scandinavia, or Siberia will still be very difficult places to survive, even when the southern lands are roasting and raked by extreme weather events. We could still make it out of this super challenge and survive, but it seems so far humans intend to learn to swim only when we are drowning. We cannot imagine the real future. Most of us cannot, but some can.
We have come here to let them know that change is coming, whether they like it or not.
There is so much I can say, but despite my decades learning and working on climate change, I cannot say it better than 16-year-old Greta Thunberg. I'm going to read a few words from her speech to the UK Parliament on April 23, 2019. I only dare to speak in her voice because the audio was so poor, interrupted by the flash of press cameras and sounds from the crowd. Greta said, "In the year 2030, I will be 26 years old. My little sister, Beta, will be 23, just like many of your own children or grandchildren. That is a great age, we have been told, when you have all of your life ahead of you, but I am not so sure it will be that great for us. I was fortunate to be born in a time and place where everyone told us to dream big. I could become whatever I wanted to. I could live wherever I wanted to. People like me had everything we needed and more. Things our grandparents could not even dream of. We had everything we could ever wish for, and yet now we may have nothing. Now we probably don't even have a future anymore. Because that future was sold so that a small number of people could make unimaginable amounts of money. It was stolen from us every time you said that the sky was the limit and that you only live once. You lied to us. You gave us false hope. You told us that the future was something to look forward to. And the saddest thing is that most children are not even aware of the fate that awaits us. We will not understand it until it is too late. And yet, we are the lucky ones. Those who will be affected the hardest are already suffering the consequences, but their voices are not heard. Is my microphone on? Can you hear me? Because I'm beginning to wonder. Around the year 2030, 10 years, 252 days, and 10 hours away from now, we will be in a position where we set off an irreversible chain reaction beyond human control. That will most likely lead to the end of our civilization as we know it. That is, unless in that time, permanent and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society have taken place, including a reduction of CO2 emissions by at least 50%. Greta Thunberg is the young stick of dynamite in our deadly carbon dream world. Those words were from her speech to the UK Parliament in April. Find a link to the full text at the Guardian newspaper or in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This song, We Don't Have Time, is from Sustainable Soundtracks featuring Adam Baptiste with the voice of Greta Thunberg. Find out more at www.wedonthavetime.org or get a link to the video in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
This one goes out to planet Earth. Each one to each one.
Listen, listen, there's a distant sound.
Yeah.
Coming closer soon, it's all around.
It's all around.
Hear me, time is running out.
Come on.
Come on, tell them what it's all about.
Yeah. We're running out of time, running out of air. Gotta keep it clean, show me you care. Wherever you are, you gotta wake up. Come on. We got a job to do, so stand up.
Yeah.
Salute life, not the general. Play fair, with your morale. We can be united as the nations, for our planet, running out of patience. Yeah.
Time now.
We don't have time. So we don't have no time now. Yeah.
Time to act, we got a world to save.
Hey. Hey.
Right or wrong now, how will you behave?
Come on.
Do the right thing as they used to say. More than ever, that is true today.
Listen. You wanna be part of the solution? Switch it up for future generations. Level up, stop wasting. You wanna know if that's water that you're tasting? Stop playing with our future. My daughter told me if my planet dies, then how would you console it? Show me some responsibility. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey. That's right, y'all. We don't have time
to ignore the signs.
We can't ignore no more.
you should do what you tell us to do. We do what you do. And since you adults don't give a damn about my future, I won't either.
Together we can do it.
We don't have time to wait.
Come on, let's go!
We ain't got no time
to ignore the signs.
Yes,
no more.
Yeah.
Out the planet Earth.
I'm Alex Smith. We'll be back with more scientists and activists next week right here on Radio EcoShock. I hope you will tune in, and thank you so much for listening.
Who would control the global climate?
Because I promise you, I say this to each of you as individuals, I promise you, a day will come when our children and grandchildren will look back and they'll ask one of two questions. Either they will ask, what in God's name were they doing? Didn't they see the evidence? Didn't they realize that four times in 15 years the entire scientific community of this world issued unanimous reports calling upon them to act? What was wrong with them? Were they too blinded and numbed by the busyness of political life or daily life to take a deep breath and look at the reality of what we're facing? Did they think it was perfectly all right to keep dumping 70 million tons every single day of global warming pollution into this Earth's atmosphere? Did they think all the scientists were wrong? What were they thinking? Or they'll ask another question. They may look back and they'll say, how did they find the uncommon moral courage to rise above politics and redeem the promise of American democracy? And do what some said was impossible. And shake things up. And tell the special interests, okay, we've heard you, and we're going to do the best we can to take your considerations into account, but we're going to do what's right.
Al Gore in testimony to the U.S. Congress, March 21st, 2007.
I think we've already entered the era of superfires, both in Canada, continental U.S., Australia, and other areas as well.
If we continue up to, you know, that 3.5 and some say 4 and indeed 6 degrees, the essential thing is this is ultimately, it's not compatible with human existence. That's the raw and the ugly truth of it, and that's why we really do need to do something about it.
Most of the world's airports, in many respects, are at sea level. You find airports everywhere along the coasts of the continents. Countries that can build airports out into the ocean, San Francisco did this, Japan does this, China did it, Honolulu. It's just the number of airports have landed in Sydney where you're just skipping the ocean and then you're on this tarmac. All of those are going to get covered over by even the 3 to 5 foot sea level rise because of storm surge.
Climate change is like the many-headed hydra. We think we know it, but we don't. The Earth is rearranging in all the places humans don't look, at sea, at the poles, deep in the melting permafrost, and in the farthest forest and mountaintops.
As long
long as I'm in this sinking ship and I have a can, I'm going to start bailing and keep working in that direction.
Radio EcoShock.